Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palaccio, your host on Heritage Radio Network. And we are pleased every week to be able to give you a little journey through culinary history of some area of cuisines or foods. And today, I am extremely happy to have a very well-known guest whose reputation precedes her, precedes this book, and her name is Joan Nathan. Many of you will know her from several of her cookbooks, as well as a PBS show she had on for several years called
Jewish Cooking in America.
With Joan Nathan, of course. Welcome, Joan.
Hi.
Joan's most recent book is called Quiches, Kugels, and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. And just before the show, Joan and I were talking, and I said, you know, I don't know, the title of the book maybe doesn't do it justice. This book is such a wonderful anthropologic research of Jews in France and a real history that you've given. And I'm very impressed, and I thank you for writing it because it puts so many things in perspective. Right. Now, you were lucky enough to go to France when you were young, but mm-hmm. It wasn't just about learning the language, right? You fell
right.
in love with
something. Well, I fell in love with the food. And actually, I'm Jewish, of course, but I never thought of Jewish food. When I was in France as a young girl, I thought of French food, and that's how I fell in love with food. And then later, when I talked to people, I realized I still thought about French food, and it wasn't until I had written books on Israeli food, American Jewish food, that I started to think about French Jewish food. And I think it was at a time when the Jews of France started thinking more about who they were. This was about 10 years ago that I started thinking about Jewish food in France, because Jews were talking more about their background. They weren't talking about it at all before.
They were getting
on with their lives after World War II, which was, you know, terrible for them. 83,000 of them were taken and killed in Auschwitz.
Yeah.
But more Jews returned to France than to any other country in Europe. So many Jews were protected by righteous Gentiles mm-hmm. throughout France. And I think that, you know, it's like my mother-in-law, who's Polish, came to this country after the war, and she didn't think about her background. She was so busy getting on with her life, making money so that her family could be provided for. And, you know, she was very poor her whole life. But it wasn't until later, before she died, that she really thought about the war. And I think it's the same thing with the French Jews and my awareness of Judaism. So I learned about Jewish food in America and Jewish food in Israel. And then I realized, wait a second, France was always the new promise or the old promised land. Jews and others came to France, certainly after the French Revolution, but even before. It was the richest agricultural country in Europe. And people flocked there. And why not? There's Paris.
That's right. Well, I was going to say, why not return once everything is settled? Because what a beautiful place to live. And that's their home, and that's their identity. You said something very interesting in the book, that they were thinking, which is what I think, and even still when I read the book, that they thought of their food as, and think of their food still as, French cuisine. It's not French Jewish cuisine necessarily until they start to examine it. So that's my next question. What is there really a French Jewish cuisine, and what is it?
Well, I would say they're French Jewish cuisines. Jews have lived in France for over 2,000 years. They came from Palestina, which was what the Romans called ancient Israel, to Rome with the destruction of the Second Temple. So there's one way.
So they were some of the earliest settlers in Gaul,
absolutely.
Right, as you mentioned. Yeah.
Exactly. So they came to Marseille and that whole area in the south of France. So there are Jews that have lived there for 2,000 years. And, of course, those are Provençal Jews. Their food is going to be southern French food. But also, that's what Jewish food was until then. Then the Jews went north to a place called Ashkenaz, and that's where the beginning of Ashkenazic cuisine, which was in Champagne, where the philosopher and rabbi Rashi lived, and in Alsace-Lorraine, and southern Germany, because, you know, the lines of a country were different then.
Right. It was the Roman Empire.
Right. So that you get Ashkenazic food that started there, like kugel, a German word, knödel for matzah balls, all those things started in northern France and southern Germany. And then they went east to Poland and Russia and came back in different incarnations.
And that's what I got from the book. There were really, you see the influences of these different areas in the food. And there's really like two or three, well, then North Africans came later. But
right.
So you see these influences very.
But North greatly. Africans came later. However, those North Africans were some of the early Jews that came became Sephardic Jews,
right.
Because they came to Catalonia. Half of Catalonia was France. And then, after the Inquisition, they went to North Africa. And then they came back
right.
again. It's so fascinating. But in addition, a lot of Russian and Polish Jews came over, so that their cooking today is more like what it was in Poland and Russia than American Jewish Eastern European cooking, because we have the imprint of America. So we've got the imprint of processed foods. We have the imprint of, for example, a cheesecake in America. We have Philadelphia cream cheesecake rather than the creme fraiche and the farmer's cheese that's in a French cheesecake.
Cheesecake, right.
And then the crust in America is mostly graham cracker crust, because Joseph Kraft, who owned Philadelphia Cream Cheese, also bought a graham cracker company and pushed his products on America's.
That's something I didn't. That's a nice new tidbit.
And in France, the cheesecake, if you go to the Marais in Paris, it has no crust. So it's less fattening.
More like a thick cheese souffle.
Right. Exactly. So that French Jewish food, I always say it's regional and religious, so that it depends on where you were from and what region you came from and what region you live in in France. So that you have also after the Inquisition, Jews from Spain and Portugal came to France as the marchands portugais, Portuguese merchants, and they brought with them chocolate from the New World that came to Spain, but chocolate as a drink. So they were the first chocolate makers in Bayonne in France. I mean, it's really interesting. And Jews have been inextricably bound with the commerce of food throughout history in France.
Well, you mentioned how they were traders in spices and different food products, obviously, right. and that's how they became valued in for their goods, and the use of these then were incorporated in the dishes
right.
as well. Interesting.
And also, just an answer to your question, there I would say that there are many Jewish French cuisines. There's Alsatian Jewish cuisine, so that it's more regional, which is very different from North African French cuisine, or Eastern European, which has a little bit of a French touch on it, but it's still Eastern European, because Jews take out the traditional recipes for the Sabbath and for holidays.
I was going to mention that you said that there you know, that's where you find the real Jewish cooking is at holiday time. And that's, I think that's true with just about any cultural ethnic background. It's always at holiday time we go to,
absolutely,
you know, to what we remember from our childhood and before. Well, you have certainly done your homework in terms of of Jewish cooking. This is what, your 10th book or
10th
book, and primarily in Jewish cooking, not everything in Jewish cooking, but you began by working in Jerusalem for the mayor there, and something that I didn't know about when you were working for Abe Beam here in New York City. Talk about food and ethnicities. You were one of the co-founders of the 9th Avenue Food Festival.
I was, indeed.
I think that is a wonderful credit, I think, because now look at where we have come as far as, that was one of the first ethnic food festivals, I think, that there was.
You know, when we started it, I was thinking about this the other day. We didn't know if anybody would show up. You know, we had no advertising budget. So we had this, had this idea, one or two of us did, and we talked to the mayor, the mayor's press secretary. So he said, I'm totally behind this idea. And he said, you can have the mayor's backing. So of course, I spoke to the recreation units. They gave us all of their recreation facilities to bring to 9th Avenue. But we couldn't get the merchants to really be interested in it until New York Magazine had a pullout on 9th Avenue. And Craig Claiborne had a full page on 9th Avenue just before. So then they suddenly got flags and you know, they got involved in it. But we were really didn't know if anybody would show up.
And this was the year on this was
1974.
Yeah.
And then when people showed up, we were just shocked at how many people showed up. It was something like 150,000 people.
Wow.
And at that time, we had people like Diana Kennedy and Michael and Ariana Batterbury outside Alps Drugstore and other places. Oh, and Pearl, what's her name? Perla Myers was one.
Oh,
another,
yeah,
one.
Perla Myers, sure.
And they were making salads, or they were talking to, it was so homespun.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, nothing stays like that.
Well,
but
then came television, and they all became stars. And now,
right, exactly. And the rest is history.
That's right, indeed, indeed. Well, what made you want to go and do this book, particularly about French Jewish cuisine?
Well, you know, I'd finished my last book, and I was trying to think of another book to write. And then I thought, wait a minute, why haven't I done French Jewish cooking? And I speak fluent French, which really is a big help. Mm. And I know many, many people in France. I have relatives in France in Annecy, and I have very good, I had a very good friend to whom I dedicated the book who died, but her children and her family are a very well-known French Jewish family. So I was able to use them to help me get other people. And I just thought that it was, nobody had ever done a book like this where just think about it. How many, when I speak around the country, I ask people, well, how many of you have ever gone to a French family? Well, very few have.
They do the tourist route.
And the French don't open their homes to you that often. The French are much more reserved than many other countries. And what I realized too, in writing this book, I learned a lot. One of the things that I learned was that, the Jewish population of France is the third largest in the world of Jewish population. So it's after the United States and Israel. Mm-hmm. And half of the, and so it's 600,000. Half of this population lives in Paris. And almost half are from North Africa. So that when there's a marriage between a North African Jew and an Ashkenazi Jew, North African wins hands down gastronomically.
Yeah.
So those are the recipes that are incorporated. And yet there are some fabulous recipes from Alsace and from Eastern Europe that
indeed
I found.
There are, and in the book, I mean, it not only is it a compendium of history, but every recipe tells a wonderful story, and you give a little insight into the family that it comes from, that you found it, and it personalizes it so much. It really is quite lovely. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the, as you say, the global aspect of the French Jewish cuisine. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Joan Nathan. ¶¶
following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Greenhorn Radio, hosted by Severin von Scharner Fleming, every Thursday at 2 p.m. Greenhorn Radio is radio for young farmers by young farmers. Helmed by acclaimed activist, farmer, and documentarian Severin Fleming, Greenhorn Radio is a weekly phone interview session surveying America's cutting-edge under 40 farmers. Again, that's every Thursday at 2 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back on A Taste of the Past, talking with Joan Nathan. And Joan is talking about Jewish cooking in France and how she uncovered a lot of the roots. And Joan has been called the doyenne of Jewish cooking by Alice Waters, and amongst others. And it's true, you are. You have done so much research. And one thing that I was interested in, you said you wrote this book. I asked you, why did you write this particular book? And of course, you had so much background in French. But then you went on to mention in one of the blurbs that says that you were really trying to figure out the difference between whether it was Jewish influence on French cuisine or vice versa. What did you find?
Well, I found lots of things. First of all, I found that Jews have been living so long in France. I looked at a lot of the recipes of the South, the Juif du Pape, and I realized that many of them are so old that you can't tell what came first, the French or the Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example, fougasse, which is, like a ladder bread. Well, I found in the 14th century somebody who, a Jewish writer, criticizing the Jews of Carpentras for dreaming about the cream and the butter that were used in the fougasse at Shavuot, which is a holiday of milk and butter in the spring, and the cherries that were embedded. And I realized, reading that, number one, what they were talking about, which was the bread, the ladder bread with holes in it, mm-hmm. of the south of France, and that this was their Sabbath bread, because why else would they be having that bread? And that they didn't have desserts then, maybe 14th, 13th century. Most people right. did. But a bread that was special like that, because I found a little, a little song that said that if you had oil in your bread, you were a Jew. And if you had, it didn't say if you had lard in it, that you weren't, then you were a goy. But the point is that this was a special bread for a special holiday, and the rest of the time you would use a kneaded bread that was for the Sabbath. And I always found little surprises like that. Another surprise, I got an email from somebody whose family was of the Juif du Pape. These were Jews that were protected by the popes mm-hmm. when Jews were kicked out of France in the 14th century, 15th, 16th century. And he said that he had a relative who was a truffle hunter, and that he made so much money finding truffles and selling it at the Carpentras Fair, that is still to this day on Friday
yeah.
and Sunday, not Saturday, that he was able to be a rabbi the rest of the year.
Huh.
So I realized that they were much more involved in food than I ever thought that they were. And I guess the other thing that I found that was, to me, very interesting was how different French Jewish food is, especially Eastern European Jewish food, from what it is in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and
what,
also,
what major difference?
Well, as I said to you before, the processed foods, and that there were another thing is we have, what a kugel is in America. Well, in France, the real kugels are really like a bread pudding. And with sautéed onions and sautéed pears and plums, and then you put on top of it a compote of pears and plums. It's delicious.
Wonderful.
But this was regional Alsace. They had wonderful pears, wonderful plums, and of course there would be dried plums and dried pears in the winter. And this is what you got at that, in that regional change from whatever you would use for the Sabbath. This was a second Sabbath dish. I guess the other thing that I really learned, I've learned so many things in this book. I feel as if I learned where Jewish food went from ancient Israel before it came to America. And I learned so much about how a food, how a cuisine gets embellished as merchants go out and discover spices and
or explore or discover the New World and bring New World foods back.
And that the Jewish community, especially of Alsace, to this day, because I always maintain that traditional foods are the last to go in a culture, they had two sauces that were 14th century. And I saw them in Taivan's cookbook. And the two sauces were carpe à la juive, which is with a parsley sauce, mm-hmm. and another one, a sweet and sour sauce, which had all kinds of spices in it. But both of them were used to this day with carp, not gefilte fish, but just carp. Cold. And it's within France, nobody uses these sauces yet to this day, but the Jews do of Alsace. Why? Because they were traditional. You use them every week for Sabbath and for the holidays, and that's what remained in a culture. So it's been going on for 400 years, and it's still there, more than 400 years.
Yeah, now we're in the 2000s. Well, that is such an important thing, is to try to, not that every, I mean, there is a globalization of cuisine, I understand, but it is, I think it's really important to a lot of us to hold on to some of these traditions, to pass on to our children so they know what it was, or put it down in books so people in the future will know, where did it come from? How did we know where this, you know, where it all started?
And the other thing that was very surprising to me, it wasn't so surprising, but I learned from it, and I have a little box in my book on pork and the Jews, and at the Dom de Comus, which was a very popular cookbook in, I think, the 17th century, in the third edition, the introduction talked about, if you really want to learn about the development of cuisine, you have to go to the Israelites, and how they have not really progressed because they don't eat pork. And what upstanding Frenchman would not eat pork? And you can see it's where the progression of cuisine is, that the Jews never would, they were so stubborn that they wouldn't adapt that. And I remember when I was interviewing so many people, it was just so much fun. I was in the south of France with a rugby player, and we spent a day together. He was introducing me to some Jewish people near where he, Osh, around that area. And he said, you know, tell me something. I remember we were looking for mushrooms at that point. He said, you know, you're just like me, but why is it you Jews don't eat pork? And it was the same thing, that it's in the French, after the French Revolution, the égalité, fraternité, liberté, but the égalité, you'd eat pork. And these stubborn Jews wouldn't do it. So it made them different.
Right. Tough question. Right. Two things that I wanted to follow up on that you just talked about. One, you said things that were precursors, and that you looked back and what came first, the chicken or the egg, because some of these dishes have been around so long, or some adaptation. And one thing that was nicely surprising, a brasados. Tell us what that is.
Oh, well, it's really interesting. It's a little bit sweeter than a bagel, but it's like a bagel, and it's from Portugal. And it's brasados. They're like a roll with a hole, but not deep fried, but baked. And this was definitely a Portuguese. So again,
a precursor
a precursor in one way to the bagel. There are others that I found in France in the in Haute Savoie. There was a boiled and baked roll with a hole, because I really think they all came from Egypt originally, mm-hmm. went to Puglia, you know, those little wonderful, I forget what they're called, the crack, they're like, I love them. They're like we call them cock.
It is.
Okay. So roll, I mean, when you think about it, how many ways did people able to sell food? So you'd take a pole and you put a roll with a hole on it.
And you'll see the pictures with the pole and all the breads pile, you know, strung on the pole.
Right. But I personally think that the, the bagel started getting boiled in Poland.
Huh.
And then for a reason that it was considered, if you boiled it and then baked it, then it would be, you could eat it you didn't have to say a prayer over it and wash your hands. Mm-hmm. But in the end, they said, yes, you did have to say a prayer over it and wash your hands, because it was in the category of bread. But the rabbis thought, or the bakers might have thought originally, well, this would be in the category of a dumpling, and therefore you wouldn't have to say a prayer. But you did have to say a prayer. But anyway, but you see the precursors. You see how food travels in mm-hmm. different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, seeing how food travels in different ways, going through these recipes, all of which are delicious and have wonderful photos accompanying them, you talked about today in France the globalization of the French Jewish cuisine. And for instance, you gave an example of a Shabbat dinner and how that would have so many different dishes from so many different regions all in the same dinner. Or, let's say, a Passover. I was talking to a friend, and she had a Passover dinner. She may have had dishes from 70 different countries at a large gathering.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, because there's so much intermarriage. Like, I remember one person was telling me that her husband was Moroccan and she was Tunisian. And Passover, there's this delicious stew called masoki, which is a Tunisian stew. And it's a lamb-based. You could do beef-based if you wanted to, but it has artichoke and spinach and mint and fava beans, and it's just beautiful. That's what the main course of the Tunisian family. But her family always had a soupy stew with fava beans that was Moroccan. So I said, well, what do you do? You have both, you know, which is a lot of work, but that's what you do. Uh-huh. And then a Friday night dinner, when I went to a Tunisian home, it would have been a meat couscous where the meat is embedded in artichoke hearts and in peppers. It's really a delicious, delicious dish.
All the stuffed vegetables you were talking about. Yeah. Provençal, I mean.
Right, exactly, Provençal. Yeah. And you can see, dishes that are similar in Provence. But this is ones that came from North Africa. Or the Sabbath stew, which is the North African Sabbath stew, is very similar to many dishes in the south of France, like cassoulet, mm-hmm. where you have beans and you have meat and you know, it's cooked overnight. There are just so many, and the salads, you know, I was speaking to somebody from Morocco who's living in this country, and he said, I miss my mother's Moroccan French cooking because she had at least 25 different salads for Friday night uh-huh. dinner. And they're wonderful. They're all cooked salads, so you can make them in advance. So they're busy cooks.
And you did a nice section on that, talking about the different dishes that are adapted specifically for the dietary laws and the rules about not lighting the fire.
Right, exactly.
So things that could be cooked long in the oven overnight and served at room temperature. Right?
Yes.
And we still see those on many tables today. Well, always see them on tables
right.
today.
Right? But it's fun to be able to look at a French, like, for example, a choucroute garni, if you want to talk about the Jews of Alsace. Mm-hmm. And you realize, if you look at old text, they criticize the choucroute and the smelliness of the Jews' stews. And you realize, wait a minute, maybe the cabbage stews were something that originated with Jews. I don't know if they did or not. But they certainly learned about pickling early on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Jews of Alsace will have sauerkraut in there with their beef as a Saturday stew, right. which is very different from the Jews of the south of France. And that was something, understanding that was something that I really learned from doing research for this book. You know, in a lot of, I think, food history research, you sort of have to think about what you're seeing. And you can't rely on history books.
No.
Because a lot of it...
They didn't write food history. I mean, you had to get somebody's diaries, basically, and find out what they sat down to dinner with, right?
Right, exactly. And you had to learn, you know, where they came from, because clearly they always say that with the Crusades, chickpeas came across. Well, whoever was leaving the Middle East, I don't care who it was, would have brought some dried chickpeas and planted them wherever they were going, because that was a staple. There were no beans.
That's right.
Other than fava beans, chickpeas, and then, of course, lentils.
Right.
And that's what they were using. Hmm. I mean, it's just fascinating to me.
Well, in talking to one of our mutual friends, Najmieh Batmajli, a couple of weeks ago, about the Persian celebration of Nowruz, the vernal equinox, so, I mean, the dishes are so many of the dishes are so similar. Well, that was the whole culture, the whole Persian Empire, then moving north and going into Gaul. So it is interesting to see how so many of these dishes migrated and then what happened to them. But I think the influences from the north are very surprising that they will appear on the same table, as you say, you know, in certain families, in certain regions. And it is a wonderful thing to explore.
Well, even a simple thing like bitter herbs for Passover, mm-hmm. which is coming up. If you take, right in France, horseradish, one of the main areas of horseradish production in the world is Alsace. And Jews, Sephardic Jews, to this day, have always used romaine lettuce or something bitter, which is really goes way back to ancient Israel when Passover was a spring festival celebrating the spring.
Right.
And so you would have whatever bitter herbs is coming up, that's what you would eat.
And that's what popped up first.
Right. Really, right, exactly. But not in Alsace. They wouldn't have had them at the time of Passover. But what bitter herbs grew up were the leaves of the horseradish root. And so they used the horseradish root as a symbol of bitter herbs. So you can see the way that traveled to Eastern Europe and traveled to America.
And then finds itself with the green on the same plate.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Have that. Well, there are so many wonderful, as I say, so many wonderful recipes in this book and so much interesting history that you did. How long did you do
it? It took me 4 years.
How many times did you go back and visit? Well, that you had to go back to France.
I know. I keep thinking about when I'm going back next. Right. I went about 6 times and they were 12-day periods. And very intensive 12 days. And, you know, what fun it was just peeking around the different communities and spending a lot of time in Paris since half the population is in Paris. Yeah.
Well, and that's interesting, too. I found that very interesting in the background that you gave, that originally most of the pockets of the Jewish communities were outside the cities, in the small towns.
Right. They were
and
not.
And now we find them all in the major cities.
Right. Well, they were not allowed to live in the major cities.
Oh, well.
So they were in the south of France. They lived in they called carrières, which were basically ghettos from the 14th century to the 18th century, that were closed at night at 8 o'clock and opened at 8 o'clock in the morning. So
we're talking not till the 1800s where they actually
emancipated. Really, right. They were not allowed to live in big towns. They had to live in small towns all over France, and they lived mostly in Alsace in the south of France. And then as soon as they were allowed to move to towns, they went to Strasbourg. They were allowed to enter towns, but they weren't allowed to live in towns. And you know, and that makes you realize that Jews in America and Israel really are very comfortable about their Jewishness. But in France, it's much more at home. It's undercover. But it's not just France. It's all over the world.
Yeah.
And that, you know, a lot of Jews don't understand that. But for sure in France, and the French are much more reserved anyway. So I had to do a lot of, you know, I felt that I was going fishing writing this book. Sometimes I would reel in a big catch. Sometimes
nothing.
A wall. Yeah. But very often people would meet me in a cafe first, which is typical of France, before they'd let me
into
theirs.
Before they invite you into the home, we'll meet someplace else.
But first, yeah. But some, I can tell you one quick story about, I was in Bergheim in Alsace with my editor, Judith Jones, and it was a beautiful, beautiful town in the wine country. And I asked a woman at this Wienstube where we went for dinner, were there any Jews in the town? Because sometimes you just didn't know what you were going to find. And she said, one. And then she said, and there's a synagogue. And this was a big synagogue in this tiny town. Well, I realized that it was a wine center in the 14th century. Ah. And now it was a cultural wine center, meaning the town. And they had this synagogue, and they had an important rabbi at that time. And then I interviewed this woman who was the one remaining person. We knocked on her door the next morning. I was with Judith Jones, my editor. And she said to me that her daughter was a really good cook, and she talked about living in Bergheim, and that her daughter wanted to come to Paris, but she really wanted to stay there because this was home for her. And she had been her husband was a butcher, Jewish, a kosher butcher before mm-hmm. the war. And as soon as the war started, Alsace was annexed, and they went down to the south of France. And he worked as a butcher, hidden, and they came back. But they came back to Alsace, where most people didn't come to these small towns because they had a business there. And I said to her, well, your daughter is, you know, is a friend of mine. Or no, I said to her, I'd like to speak to your daughter. She said, she'll call in a few minutes, but look at the television right now, because she's on television. She's like the Barbara Walters. She didn't say that,
yeah.
but I said that, of France. So she was on television, and then the phone call. And then the mother said, she'll call me to see if I'm alive. So she calls her afterwards. And by before then, the mother said to me that she was a great cook. She made wonderful pot-au-feu, and she made wonderful Alsatian kugel that I was describing to you before. And then I got on the phone with her, and she said, I want to speak to my mother's helper. And then I got her telephone number. I could see she just wanted to get rid of me. So I met her in Paris, and she, again, met me at a cafe near the Assemblée Générale, where she was doing reporting. And then we got along great. We have become very good friends. She's had me over for dinner. She's in the book, and I have these wonderful recipes from her. So you never know what you're going to get and what you're not going to get and where it's going to lead. And that's what's beautiful about this kind of food writing.
Yeah. Well, the stories truly are beautiful. They're beautiful stories, and the history is very informative. And the recipes are delicious, and the pictures. I had to stop reading when I was hungry one evening because it was killing me. The pictures were beautiful and mouthwatering. And the book, again, is called Keisha's Kugels and Couscous, My Search for Jewish Cooking in France. Joan Nathan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me on A Taste of the Past. And as always, I'm Linda Palacio, and I hope you'll join us next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network.
Everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.